Hello, and welcome to part two of Healthcare Reimbursement Conundrum, Priorities and Strategies for Commercial Payer Reimbursement in the COVID-19 Environment webinar, presented by Pulsinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If you are experiencing any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pulsinelli shareholder Jonathan Buck.
Thank you, Ashley. My name is Jonathan Buck, and I'm a shareholder in Pulsinelli's Los Angeles office. With me today, I have presenting Ryan Morgan, an associate from our Denver office, and Mary Gordon of counsel from our Nashville office. We wanted to thank you for joining us today as we talk about some priority areas and various strategies for addressing commercial payer reimbursement in this COVID-19 environment. As an initial apology, since I'm from California in the Los Angeles office, I want to apologize for the choking air that we are transmitting throughout the country. I've been getting a hard time from relatives in the Midwest, and suffice it to say, it's no fun for everyone, but I just wanted to extend some apologies there. For purposes of our presentation today, we're looking at some various topics that are becoming regular conversation points with our respective clients. First and foremost, claims reimbursement issues that are occurring with services related to COVID-19 and flowing from COVID-19 and various changes in care delivery that's been impacted as a result of COVID-19. Second, resolving open receivables and taking this opportunity to address past claims that preceded COVID-19 with your commercial payer relationships. And then finally, responding to some recoupments and overpayment requests. We're finding that a lot of these different activities are not ceasing during the COVID environment. So what I'd like to spend the next 15 or 20 minutes talking about are some of the reimbursement challenges clients are facing during the COVID-19 pandemic. One good opportunity that's coming up is that this finite period of time is providing really a snapshot and an opportunity for providers to really segment these specific claims issues that come up in the COVID-19 services and address them with the respective payers. We're also talking about certainly other aspects of the healthcare relationships with commercial payers that have not ceased and even continue on. So we're seeing our clients receiving a lot of unilateral contract amendments or policy changes, and then having to deal with kind of an influx of non-contracted payer reimbursement for patients who've accessed your providers through the emergency room. With respect to COVID-19 services, we're finding various finite aspects in the area of services that are related to the diagnosis of COVID-19 or treating those patients, laboratory testing, and making sure that patient responsibility has been properly waived where it's supposed to be. With COVID-19 diagnosis services, we're recommending our clients certainly take this opportunity. Now that we're, a good 6 months into it, you should have a good representative sample of where some payer issues are occurring with, are they actually paying your claims correctly? Are they applying the proper patient responsibility or waiving it and making sure that they, the payer, have paid those amounts? And we're also finding issues with our clients who have not necessarily billed the proper codes and modifiers related to COVID-19 services. With laboratory testing, this has continued to be a bit of a challenge for some, where there are issues with the diagnostic testing, whether the antibody testing is being properly paid. We're finding a lot of patients being held responsible for various lab testing services. And so we'd recommend that you certainly take a finite look at your various COVID service claims for this time period And if you have identified problems, now is the time to really raise them to the payers and get them cleaned up. There will only be so much further time period of the emergency orders and the pandemic. And so taking care of these now and addressing them with your respective payers is a very important thing to address in a timely fashion. The other thing that we're seeing is that many of our clients have had to modify their delivery during this COVID-19 pandemic. This could be obviously the increase in telehealth services and making sure you're getting paid by the payers appropriately for those services to their members. We've also seen many claims get held up due to alternative delivery sites where hospitals and various other facilities had to modify where they are providing care to patients within their system. We're also seeing extended stays due to either required testing and clearance or quarantining patients in special units. And these are leading to claims that might be a little bit longer in terms of length of stay or have different levels of care with them. But the payers may only pay for a certain finite part of the claim. So some considerations that we're looking at with respect to these types of claims are, you know, are the commercial payers adhering to those applicable state or federal waivers? And while they might not be applicable on their face to these payers, many have adopted them. So it's very important to know what types of waivers or other types of relief, for instance, these commercial payers have granted in line with state and federal waivers on government program type claims. Another thing is it's very important to make sure that you document authorizations or requests for services, have communicated any sort of special service protocols to those payers as part of treating their members in alternative ways, and using that documentation to make sure you're getting paid in full for the services that you're provided. You know, it's also very important to understand what basis the payers have made for any sort of denial or underpayment that is occurring on these claims. Again, you may have received partial payment, but not full payment. So what is the rationale that they are providing for not paying the full portion of the claim? We often find that just sending lists of claims to payers with no detail as to why their decisions were wrong is not going to help advance the cause of getting full reimbursement. But, you know, with each of these issues and these types of subcategories, you're able to group these claims together and present them to the payers as perhaps a special project. And again, trying to get resolution and clear standards of what that payer is going to do with respect to your claims and payments, you know, resolve even before the pandemic period ends. On the flip side of this, unrelated to claims, we're seeing that commercial payers are continuing to issue unilateral amendments, either contract amendments, which revise material terms of your agreement. Some of these could be COVID-specific, like lab testing rates came out early on, where payers were seeking to impose Medicare rates or even Medicaid rates as the basis for reimbursement of lab services on commercial payer claims. We also see a lot of amendments come out that purport to be regulatory amendments, don't need signature, but yet the amendments themselves don't necessarily really comport to what the law is, or they include additional things that are not required by law, but simply by having them accepted, do become part of your contract. And finally, we find a lot of unilateral amendments coming out for various policy changes, provider operations manual changes, and some of these might be material in terms of impacting reimbursement. On the other side, you know, these can also impose, you know, material costs to you by based on having an increased process, or you have to increase resources in order to comply with the new process. All in all, these types of unilateral amendments are being implemented simply to modify your rights or obligations without your permission. We you know, despite COVID going on, these amendments have not ceased, and they're in fact picking up steam. And so we're finding that a lot of providers might have neglected during this time looking at and objecting to these. But it's very important to be on top of and make sure you are seeing any of these unilateral amendments that come through so that you can take timely action to respond. And the first step with this is to assess the changes that are coming out. Are they material? Do they conflict with terms that are already existing in your contract? Or are they something completely new and different? We see a lot of these amendments changing routine language in your contract where you've negotiated a definition of medical necessity, you're eligible to provide certain site of service services in a certain site of service. So a lot of them are focused on modifying what providers are eligible to provide in their hospital or outpatient departments. All of these can serve to really change your expectations of what you thought the contract was going to provide for you. And it's also going to impact you in a way that you had not anticipated. With many of these site of service policies, we're seeing that when a provider was previously eligible to provide certain services in their facility, all of a sudden those services will no longer be authorized and allowed to be provided in your facility. And if you do provide them, they're going to deny the claims. You know, other things like broad medical policies, you know, those come up very often from the various payers, but some of them may have a very material effect. So first and foremost, it's important to not only receive the policy, but assess the change being made and understand the impact it's going to have on you as a provider. The next critical step is understanding what your contract rights and obligations are when these policy changes come in. And if your contract terms do not really support a very efficient process so that you can receive notice of these changes and react to them, it is something that you should be considering for the future and changes in your agreement. So for instance, contract terms surrounding these, it's very important to know what notice is required for changes to be made, whether it's an amendment to the agreement or policy or procedure manual. Did the payer follow it? What protections do you already have in your agreement? Are you allowed to be made whole for any material change, for instance? Is there a dispute resolution process to determine that? Various states also have requirements or protections for providers against unilateral amendments. And so it's very important to know if you have any such protections. And all in all, make sure you understand the time frames in which you have to respond to proper notice of a unilateral amendment. Even if one of these amendments come through and you feel you have a existing term in your agreement, it's directly conflicting with this new policy that's outside the agreement, it is still best practice to submit a letter, an objection to the plan advising of, you know, the existing contract provision that you're relying on, that you're objecting to any change to that, and you expect that commercial payer not to impose that policy on you in violation of the contract terms. Similarly, we're often seeing providers who did not receive notice of policy changes, but then have a series of claims that are impacted by them. And so it's going to be very important to promptly jump on those claims, escalate them as through the terms in your contract, and begin to seek resolution with that payer on the dispute. And part of the objection and appeal should be you were never given proper notice of these policy changes. We're also even seeing policy changes applicable to non-contracted payers. So various providers throughout the country are defining various codes for emergency room that they will automatically pay and others that they will automatically review. And so even when you are not a contracted provider, there are policies that impact how that payer is going to behave with respect to your claims. Finally, with the influx of non-contracted payer members accessing providers through the emergency room, we're seeing more and more payers using unilaterally derived amounts to reimburse those services. This is coming up in a variety of contexts, but you know, the historical and typical one was a usual and customary basis for payment, but now we're seeing more and more reference pricing used by non-contracted payers, and specifically employers who engage with a repricing company, and they have changed their benefit plans, if you will, likely in response to the ACA and the Affordable Care Act, so that reference pricing is what's contained in their benefit plan for out-of-network reimbursement. And reference pricing is really referring to a common reimbursement methodology such as Medicare, and having a coverage limitation agreement, for instance, that for out-of-network services, we only cover 160% of Medicare as the reference price. The other thing that is continuing to occur is that on non-contracted claims and even on contracted claims, we're seeing a lot of line item denials where payers are giving their own unilateral interpretation of CMS bundling and unbundling rules and specifically lining out and denying payment for various items on your bill because they allege that those items are included in either the room and board rate, included in a surgery room rate, or are routine supplies. All of these tactics, especially in the non-contracted realm, do need to be promptly addressed and objected to and appealed. The other aspect that really impacts how providers need to approach this is they need to be aware of what surprise billing laws might exist in their state. We've seen a lot of states adopt new laws in the last couple of years. We see continued discussion at the federal level to find a surprise billing standard across the land, if you will, and how you are able to bill a patient and what you are able to bill a patient does vary across states, and even within states, it varies across products. So, for instance, here in California, we have limitations on an HMO side and some other limitations on a PPO side, but the ERISA side is not addressed. And so even though you might, it's not a one-size-fits-all, so you have to be definitely mindful if you plan to balance bill or submit bills to patients of what your law's requirements are. Oftentimes, the laws we're seeing that are getting adopted are requiring that the provider only dispute the payment amount with the payer, and that there will be a special arbitration process that needs to be followed in order to challenge that. And those limited time frames that come into these processes will impact your rights. So, for instance, if you haven't followed the process under these laws, you may be further foreclosed from ever further challenging that reimbursement amount. Some special considerations as you deal with your out-of-network disputes is to understand what rights are assigned by patients in assignment of benefits. Oftentimes, an assignment of benefits is really just limited to authorizing the provider to receive direct payment from a patient's out-of-network plan. This doesn't necessarily often give the providers the right to essentially step in the patient's shoes and either assert ERISA claims or, you know, assign their appeal rights or even power of attorney. So it's definitely important to understand what rights you have to challenge these beyond your own. You also need to really look at and see if the denial issue involved is merely a pricing level issue or if there are other aspects involved. And we find there's usually multiple issues that may be involved. You will have certain things denied for medical necessity or not authorized. You will have certain pieces denied for a line item denial, and then you will have a usual and customary or other type of pricing issue related. Certainly in these cases, you need to identify the true payer and the product type. Oftentimes, non-contracted payments do come from the insurer themselves, but when you get into the self-funded ERISA plan context, often that payment is coming from a third-party administrator, or it's coming from one of these repricing companies that they've engaged. And then finally, going back to the self-pay responsibility and balanced billing laws, you know, certainly focus on what patient responsibility has been identified on those EOBs. We recommend that you certainly review your course of dealing with an out-of-network payer. We often find that our provider clients have certain, perhaps single case letters of agreement at a certain reimbursement rate, but then a whole bunch of other claims that were not covered by such single case agreements, and the plan has paid significantly well below what they agreed to in a single case agreement. So those course of dealings can serve as arguments and a basis for higher reimbursement as you get into a dispute with a payer. But definitely understand, especially when you're dealing in the self-funded ERISA plan context, that administrative appeal requirements still apply and that there's going to be a need to make sure that you've exhausted some of those administrative remedies, such as appeals. We always recommend that when you're dealing with an out-of-network payer, you know, it's important to have an organizational strategy. Are you just looking to resolve the claims that have been impacted, but the volume doesn't rise to the level where this payer needs to, you know, perhaps be under contract, or is there an objective to obtain a contract with that? That can, you know, having a strategy on either one of those levels will kind of dictate what your best approach is with those payers. But because of these administrative appeal requirements, exhausting administrative remedies, we do recommend that our providers file at least one or two levels of appeal in a very prompt and timely basis, because oftentimes underlying benefit plan agreements will have shortened appeal time frames that might not be what you experience on your state law side or your regulated HMO product side. As part of those appeals, we recommend that you assess, you know, the basis and methodology by which the payer paid, and request that they not only provide you a copy of the benefit plan, but that the payer demonstrate compliance with the Affordable Care Act's Grace of Three methodology. One other little nuance that comes up that does also impact timing is if a payer has attempted to effectuate an accord and satisfaction. And in this instance, with an accord and satisfaction, what the payers will do will be to send a check along with the EOB, and the check will be notated payment in full, and that if you execute the check, you have accepted that amount as total payment for the claim and can't pursue either the patient or the insurer. With those accord and satisfactions, different states have different laws, but generally it's going to require a full response back to that payer within 90 days, and oftentimes in order to further challenge the amount and basis of the reimbursement, you might have to refund that initial payment to them. You know, further escalation after you've appealed these and certainly gathered those claims, you know, it's a certainly good practice to send either an attorney demand letter if you're just seeking to resolve the claims, or, you know, work with your managed care department to incorporate into a broader proposal to try and both resolve past non-contracted claims and look at an arrangement moving forward. You know, finally, your final recourse will be litigation, since they're out of network and there's no contract dictating. We do see some payers receptive to arbitrating or mediating these types of disputes, but that will be by stipulation. And so unless there's an ongoing conversation and discussion, there's probably going to be a need to commence litigation if you're going to get any resolution on it. I want now to turn to my colleague, Ryan Morgan, who's going to talk about strategies to address claims preceding the code environment and trying to take this opportunity to work with your payer partners and really clean up as we enter a new realm coming out of COVID. Ryan?
Thanks, Jonathan. Now, Jonathan touched on a bunch of concepts on focusing on securing reimbursement for COVID-related claims. Maybe unsurprisingly, a lot of those same concepts are going to be at play here with respect to claims kind of pre-COVID or not related to COVID. But just kind of hang with me. I think it's an important overview of kind of the expectations of both payers and providers in securing this type of reimbursement. So I'm going to walk through what's probably a normal process or what I think should be a normal process for identifying and resolving issues with underpayments. In some ways, this process and the things I talk about is a little bit of my wish list. I view these as kind of common stumbling blocks, usually in cases where I'm consulted in a dispute later in the game, and these kind of these boxes weren't checked originally, and it kind of causes some issues. So let's walk through these. The process, I think, deserves special attention now during the COVID period for two reasons. First, because a lot of providers are struggling financially and need cash, and identifying and securing payment for underpayments or denials is one means of doing that. And two, because as we'll discuss on the next slide, payers might be motivated to pay, actually. COVID has been really the best thing that could have possibly happened to health insurers. They collected all their premium, and then a couple months into the plan year, all the providers were shut down. And then, you know, obviously they don't have to pay anything. So perhaps unsurprisingly, that's led to record profits for insurers. Personal note, I checked one of the mutual funds I invest in recently thinking, you know, let's just see how much I'm getting killed. It turns out that fund invests in United Health Group, and United Health Group is absolutely carrying that entire fund. If you look at stock prices, and I kind of just glanced at all of the major payers, the for-profit payers at least, their stock prices from late March to today have almost doubled across the board. Kind of incredible. And you can kind of see that reflected in their Q2 profits, which are listed here. They're all in the billions, multiple billions of dollars. All of those numbers are almost double the profit amounts reported from quarter two of 2019. So they are just sitting in a great position right now, and are sitting on a ton of cash. That's great for them, but they're also stuck with so it doesn't maximum loss ratio. That's to say medical loss ratio concerns. For those who aren't familiar with that, the MLR is a legal requirement for insurers to spend a certain percentage of premium dollars on medical claims and not on, for example, administrative costs, employee salaries, and certainly not on profits. Those will be on the other side of the bucket for MLR ratio calculations. It's obviously more complicated than that, but still, MLR requirements effectively cap profit margins for payers. And what do they do with the excess payment? They're required to rebate those payments to policyholders if they can't meet those MLR requirements. So, for example, the Affordable Care Act established for most self-funded plans and for Medicare Advantage, the certain percentage requirements in the large group market and the small group market, you can kind of see them there. Those numbers are similar to state requirements that for state regulated products. So they might not be 85 and 80%, but you know, it's kind of in that realm somewhere. And payers are simply not allowed to spend more than, in the case of Affordable Care Act large group products, more than 15% of revenue on administrative and profit, which means they have if they're sitting on a bunch of money right now, they're probably not going to meet their MLR requirements at the end of the year. Now, that sets up a situation where, you know, they might be in a position to kind of grease the wheels a little bit and resolve provider underpayments when those payments are, of course, legally supportable. So I think there's an opportunity for all providers to kind of consider where they are right now financially, whether they have an opportunity to identify underpayments on their books when, you know, maybe they normally wouldn't because it's kind of not worth the hassle to secure the money. Well, maybe it's going to be a little easier this time around because of COVID. I'll note that for, you know, kind of describing the window here, it's obviously right now would be a great time to start, but that window probably won't close until somewhere in quarter two of 2021 because MLR reporting windows, you know, they're typically in the middle of the next plan year to permit some time for run out claims and other things that they have to kind of reconcile at the end of the year. So I think you've got maybe 6 months from now, maybe a little bit more, to kind of work your underpayments and see if you can take a shot here at something that might not have worked pre-COVID. So how are we going to do that? Well, first step is to identify your underpayments. And I'll point out here that, you know, everything from here on out also applies to disputed overpayments. I kind of view those in the same bucket as underpayments, particularly when the payer has offset or recouped those amounts. So from your perspective, it's all an underpayment. So kind of keep that in mind as we go through here. It's not just, you know, having been denied or having been underpaid on a claim, but it's also overpayments that you think were recouped improperly. The first step, of course, is still the same. It's identify the underpayments. The easiest way to do that is to kind of look, you know, use your normal course of business to flag improper denials or improper underpayments, and of course recouped overpayments. Those are the ones that you probably already know about and don't have to go digging for. But I think there's also probably for many providers an opportunity to go digging for it and, you know, do some type of internal claims audit or self audit to kind of figure out whether you've been paid correctly. Auditing everything in terms of scope is the best way to do it. Obviously, you can go and hire a professional claims auditor to come in and look at everything. That's probably not realistic for most providers, nor is it probably the most efficient way of kind of searching for underpayments. So you've got probably a better way to do it is to identify high risk or high dollar issues that have the potential for payer overreach or payer mistakes. Things like prioritizing your top procedure codes, things like IDing issues that a payer is likely to have messed up. That, of course, varies by payer, so, you know, you kind of have to, there's no one-size-fits-all here. But you can see through the bullet points there that there are a number of items that you might want to consider focusing your self-audit on. Incorrectly priced claims is one that I flag here, kind of in response to what Jonathan talked about in terms of UCR for out-of-network disputes, because, you know, if you guys remember the Ingenix lawsuits from about a decade ago, that was a class action where Aetna maintained a very, very detailed database of claims data from all over the place and used it to establish UCR for out-of-network providers. That's usual and customary rates for out-of-network providers, and other payers use that exact same database. It looked very sophisticated. It looked very detailed. It looked like a well-run system. It wasn't. The data it relied on was simply flawed and resulted in improper payments. And that lawsuit resulted in multiple $100 million settlements, and for good reason. So, it might be worth taking a look at whether pricing on your claims is appropriate, whether in your contracted environments, whether your payer sent that bill to a repricer who might be using other types of mechanisms or methodologies that you weren't aware of to figure out pricing on your claim. Okay, so you did your self-audit and you ID'd some potential buckets of overpayments. Next step is to figure out whether you're actually entitled to the money. So we've got kind of a little flow chart here. It's typically going to require a multi-specialty approach. Best if it involves legal early on. Will certainly involve revenue cycle billing, folks who can get down in the weeds, find the data you need, and take a good look at it. The goal at the end of the day is to get to a number that values your underpayment. It's a, kind of the total dollar amount for a specific issue, for a specific payer, to which you're legally entitled. That's the goal here because that's what you want to present to a payer in an easily digestible format, like kind of Jonathan alluded to earlier. You don't want a data dump on a payer. That's going to be unproductive at the end of the day. You want to give them a clear message, a clear number that, you know, there's not much to really quibble about, and then just say, give me my money. So the first step is going to be contract review. It seems like a simple task, but first you need to ID the payers involved and whether you even have a contract with those payers. And so contract review step could involve, you know, reviewing dozens of contracts, dozens of payer policies at issue, and the need to review applicable state and federal law to assess the viability of out-of-network claims. So we'll talk a little bit more about the contract review piece on the next slide, but I want to touch on the other two just a little bit. Doing a claims review for each payer is probably similar to the internal audit step you kind of did before. There's probably some overlap, and that's okay, but the internal audit step focuses on, in my view, searching for and identifying underpayments. The claims review step focuses on, you know, whether your original claim as you submitted it was sufficient. And those claims requirements might vary by payer. Was the site of service correct? You know, was there a prior authorization number included? That type of thing. So it's an important step just to absolutely confirm that the claims you're presenting to the payer as underpaid were underpaid solely as a result of payer error and not because of something that, you know, you on the provider side could have done or should have done better. Your doc review is going to be similar to the claims review. The goal is really to ensure the documentation supporting the claim is sufficient. That's going to primarily include medical record requirements, but, you know, we'll also touch on things like, I don't know, you know, prescription information or prescriber information if you properly documented that. Sometimes the claims review and the documentation review steps are pretty quick, almost box checking exercises because you're confident in your process and everything went out the door the right way. That's great. But sometimes they can take a lot of time and manpower, and, you know, particularly when that documentation is the crux of the underpayment argument. So contract terms, you're going to want to look for a couple of different things. First, you want to make sure that the payer is actually liable for payment. And there's nothing in the contract that, you know, allows the payer to raise their hand and say, not me, not me. So looking for the definition of covered service, looking for carve-out services that the payer might kick to a special vendor, behavioral health's a classic one. Making sure all conditions to payment are met, which we kind of touched on and really should be something that's part of the claims review and documentation review process. On the payer defense side, you're going to want to start looking for the argument that the payer is going to raise after you send them all your data. The most important one, I think, is probably any kind of contractual or statutory limitation period. 12 to 18 month look back is standard, although it varies, and you're going to have to look to your contracts for that number if there is one. That look back basically means you're not allowed to dispute the claim after a certain time period has passed. Failure to exhaust payer administrative appeals processes is another important one that's often a contractual requirement as well, meaning, you know, if you haven't appealed this all the way through the entire administrative process that the payer maintains and, you know, which resulted in a denial at the end of the day, then you can't further pursue that claim through, you know, alternative dispute resolution or other means. Often we will assert a right to prompt payment penalties on these underpayment disputes. Those prompt payment penalties and other types of provider rights that are based in state law are often preempted by ERISA. And even if you kind of show a payer, hey, here are all the claims you paid that you owe me, many of those claims might involve ERISA self-funded plans, and will actually be preempted. So it gets a little tricky to assert those state law arguments. Not that you shouldn't, but I think it's something to flag on the contract review step. Finally, I want to point out that there's also the possibility that the payer could say, it's not me that's responsible for payment because this is a lease network and or a silent PPO, and that someone else, some other payer out there, is the one that ultimately made payment to you, and you need to go work it out with that payer. That's fine, but again, let's identify that at the outset and make sure we're directing communications to the right party. Okay, we mentioned this just a second ago, but the need to initiate claims appeals is, I think, increasingly important. You have to work these things through the normal payer process for claims appeals. It's best practice to kind of send all of those documentation items that I kind of mentioned there in the bullet points, but it's actually more important to technically submit the appeal. So get that out the door. The clock is ticking. And you don't want to give the payer that argument that you haven't exhausted their process if you don't have to. There may be an opportunity to pursue bulk appeals as opposed to appealing on a claim-by-claim basis. This is often the case when there's a common issue underlying an underpayment, so there may be an opportunity to pursue that. The bulk appeal for all of those claims presenting the same issue. This process is sometimes not set forth in the provider manual, and something that you have to kind of dig for to see if it's available at the payer. Jonathan, if you're with me here, I think you have done a bit of work on the California side, where I know there's a statutory right to bulk appeals. Do you think you can talk for a second or two about that?
That's correct. In California, our HMO laws and regulations do provide for not only individual provider disputes on a claim level, but also submission of bulk appeals with claims that have a similar issue or denial or underpayment reason. And with those, it allows you to not only present all the claims with a similar issue in one spreadsheet and one appeal form, but it also helps serve and address various limited timing requirements. So typically, if you have to appeal an individual claim within 365 days, a bulk appeal allows you to appeal the entire group within 365 days from the date of the plan's last action on those claims. And so sometimes that helps you rejuvenate claims that would otherwise be untimely for an appeal or provider dispute perspective. So when we have common issues, and oftentimes if a health plan's done something once, they've done it multiple times, we find this is a very viable strategy to help make it more efficient, as well as help protect some of those claims that might not have been timely appealed in the first place.
Yeah, that's great. And kind of along the same lines, I wouldn't be too discouraged if your deadline for appeal has already expired. We are sometimes able to argue around those types of requirements. It's sometimes fairly technical legal arguments, but we can sometimes get around it. And as we said, in this environment, the payers might be willing to overlook, a technical appeal deadline in favor of kind of making a payment to a claim to avoid MLR expectation. Okay, so at this point in the process, you probably have a good understanding of the scope of the underpayment and the reason you're entitled to it. There's one more step to take before kind of formally committing to arbitration or litigation, and it's really my favorite step. This pre-arbitration or litigation step can take many different forms depending on the circumstances. You might want to just formally trigger the dispute resolution process under the contract. There's often kind of a requirement for the parties to get together and talk before there's any kind of formal action taken, and that can be a very helpful step in resolving underpayments, particularly when your right to payment is is pretty solid and indisputable. You can maybe avoid getting lawyers involved if that's the case. But, you know, more often I see that there's an opportunity to send a legal demand letter. And often, you know, just putting your demand in writing with all of your legal arguments, with all of your supporting documentation kind of put together in a nice little package for the payer, and putting it on legal letterhead is exactly what you need to kind of break up the logjam that you might have experienced on the appeals administrative side. So I just love sending demand letters because often payers are just wrong. I mean, they're big and bureaucratic, and they have standard claims processing procedures that don't make sense for many, many, many situations, and the payer has no interest in correcting them. So I kind of really love when the facts line up perfectly and we can just kind of hammer a payer and get a really good result. So I mentioned earlier that the kind of process we discussed applies to recouped overpayments as well as pure underpayments. Payer recoupment action has not abated during COVID, which I'm sure Mary can talk to a little bit more, but she's going to give us a little more insight on audits, recoupments, and offsets.
Okay. Hello, everybody, and we're so glad that you've hung out with us for this long. We only have about 15 minutes left, but I think I can get through this presentation, this portion of it, pretty quickly. So I'll speak briefly about audits, and then I'll dig into recoupments and offsets that often result is from those audits. So just to explain, I am a healthcare litigator, so my advice will glean from my experience from these issues when they've gotten really heated and they couldn't be resolved otherwise. And in the course of my experience, I have learned like what can be like fatal flaws in the process of challenging a recoupment or challenging any type of underpayment scheme or denial scheme. And so we always advise our provider clients to really tighten up those processes, as both Jonathan and Ryan have mentioned during their parts of the presentation. So when you get to me, when you get to the time when you think you're going to have to pull the trigger, you have everything in a nice, neat, orderly place. Now, of course, that is not required because, as Ryan said, we can argue through issues, maybe like timely filing issues, something like that. We can explain some extenuating circumstances, especially now in the period of COVID and during the emergency period. But we really like to see claims nice and tidy by the time they get to us. So we think this is a great time to look back at your processes and tighten up any loose ends there. So just as Ryan mentioned, payers, you know, they're continuing to audit through the emergency period and issue those recoupments that none of us like. And unfortunately, COVID have not suspended the time frames for responding to recoupments and to challenging audits. So just as a part of background, payers will use the audit process, the post-payment audit process is what I'm speaking to quote-unquote discover payment discrepancies. And of course, they will be labeled as overpayments. So after an audit is conducted, the payer will seek to capture the alleged overpayments through a recoupment request. Okay, and I like to say request because a lot of times they're like, you must pay this. And it's my job to say, I do not have to pay that. So if you're in network, and they'll try to justify the recoupment maybe through a term of the contract, if applicable. And whether you're in or out of network with a particular payer, the recoupment could be based on an internal policy. So the policies that we see now that are triggering a lot of audits and recoupments are going to be about bundling. They're going to be about incidental procedures that are tied to a primary service, perhaps under the new sepsis 3 definition, if any of you guys have seen that on your end, and then avoidable readmissions, audits, and recoupments. So that's just an example of ones we've seen lately. So payers, most of y'all probably understand the difference between a recoupment and an offset, but I think it's prudent to kind of go through that for anyone who's on the call that is new to managed care. So payers will use recoupment to resolve a payment discrepancy by initially sending what they call a notice of overpayment to the provider and then allowing the provider a set amount of time that could be set by the contract or by state law or a made-up time period and to repay the alleged overpayment. And generally, a nice recoupment process will allow the provider to appeal and to challenge it. And depending on the gravity of the recoupment or how much they're asking, I sometimes get involved in this part of the appeal process. So payers will use the offset part of the mechanism. I'm sorry, I forgot to go through my slides. To withhold payments on current claims as a credit towards an alleged overpayment on a past claim. So what they'll do is they'll mark the current claim as paid on the EOB, which we do not like, even though they didn't actually give any money to or any benefits on that particular claim. And they use it to offset an alleged debt for a previous claim. And we consider this, and state laws consider this, as a self-help mechanism. So you're probably familiar with that terminology. So there's different ways that we like to challenge a recoupment or an offset if it's gotten to that, or if they somehow skipped the recoupment phase and went straight to offsets, which unfortunately we have seen. So this is, we're going to talk about if you are in network with the payer who's trying to recoup from you. So we're going to challenge that recoupment as a breach of the contract potentially, okay? So like what Ryan was saying, it is really important that you understand the terms of your contract. I advise providers to assign a person who is in charge of every contract and knows that contract in and out, especially as in regards to time periods. So if you're in network, that contract will likely govern, hopefully, the right to audit primarily, and then the right to then recoup on the back line. So failure to meet any timelines in that contract as it relates to an audit or a recoupment can be fatal to a future challenge. So it doesn't have to be. We still pursue those, but we like to see that those timeframes are met. So the first thing is you need to determine is, was that audit initiated and conducted under the terms of the contract? So, for example, we see a lot of contracts where it says, if you're going to audit me, you have to come into my office, I give you the room, I give you the files, and you have to audit them in front of my face, okay? And sometimes we'll see ones where we require a certain amount of like time notice. Like, I need 60 days if you're going to audit me, that sort of thing. So look to see if that audit initially was conducted according to the contract and then or to any laws that might be incorporated into the contract. That's just as important because we've seen many state laws that will govern this process, and those state laws can be incorporated by reference into your contract. So then the providers must determine if the recoupment was properly noticed. So that's really important, and whether any applicable appeals processes were followed or and allowed according to the contract. And, as you know, state laws may also govern in-network recoupment processes. So look at that. So that leads me to my next slide, how you can challenge these according to state laws. So many states have laws. Let me get to the next slide. Sorry. That govern recoupment. These laws will set the time period for which a payer may recoup claims. What we mostly see is 1 to 2 years. The most popular seems to be 18 months. It will define the framework by which a payer must give notice and allow appeals of the recoupment request. And it will allow or prohibit offsets. Oftentimes, we'll see state statutes that are silent on that, actually. And then they will provide the exemptions such as fraud or intentional misconduct. So we advise to look for terms in the contract that will incorporate those state laws, and then look for state law provisions that prohibit contracting around the statute. So what we've seen, for example, in Illinois, we'll have a state statute that says, listen, no matter what your contract says, you have to follow this procedure if you're going to initiate and act on a recoupment. And you're not allowed to contract around that. So for out-of-network, note that recoupment statutes, the one I was just referring to, may be preempted by ERISA. And for all of you people out there, ERISA is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. And most employer-sponsored plans are governed by ERISA, except, as you know, the governmental plans like the City of Nashville or exchange plans or church plans. So, and a novel way that we are starting to challenge recoupments is through each state's voluntary payment rule. So we have seen a large handful of states who have adopted the voluntary payment rule. And that is an equitable defense. And a person, it basically says that a person cannot recover money which is voluntarily paid with the full knowledge of the facts. Of course, there are exceptions. You will see fraud, duress, or mistake of fact. So what we will generally see from the payer is that they said, listen, I paid this not knowing all the facts. But we like to challenge that. And then through ERISA, you can challenge a recoupment because in many jurisdictions, recoupments are can be considered adverse benefit determinations. And when you have an adverse benefit determination at play in an ERISA plan, that's going to trigger a lot of protections. So we're looking here at disclosure requirements, okay, that would be required for recoupment requests, and that would be a reason for the recoupment for each claim, a reference to a specific plan provision on which the decision was made, an offer to provide relevant documents, a description of the appeals process, and perhaps even the production of an internal rule on which the recoupment request was made. That will also trigger protections of notice, appeals, and the document production. So the appeals are very important there. And to get to this level, if you're an out-of-network and you're going to challenge a recoupment based on ERISA, you need to have that broad assignment of benefits signed by each of the patients. That is crucial. And as a provider can never predict when it will be hit with the recoupment, each patient should have signed a broad AOB that will give you a right to challenge the recoupment under ERISA, and this is crucial for our out-of-network providers. So here I have a list of what we'd like to see in an assignment of benefits. So this provides the provider who is out-of-network the standing they will need to file a lawsuit in court to challenge a recoupment and offset. And that's going to be the right to file claims, file appeals, and file the lawsuit. And what you're going to ask for is both legal and equitable relief and your penalties. The right to request all documents and information on which the payer relied when it made the demand. And this applies to each claim subject to the demand. And we see these recoupment requests, and they'll talk about 200, 300 claims, if not even more. And then most out-of-network provider-initiated lawsuits, they're going to be dismissed due to this lack of a sufficient AOB. Okay, so here you think you're in, you have your broad AOB, and you're challenging a recoupment, and what happens? The payer says, sorry, your AOB does not apply. We're not going to recognize it because we have an anti-assignment clause within our health benefit plan. So more and more payers we see are doing this, and so we are developing ways to get around that, and luckily some case law is helping us out. So what you'll see here is that in American Orthopedics versus Horizon Blue, a case out of New Jersey, they said, okay, you may be able to use a power of attorney that will get around an anti-assignment clause in a healthcare benefit plan. And so if you can also have your patients, although it is an administrative burden, execute a POA, giving you the rights that you would be the same rights as under the AOB, then you could get around that provision and file your lawsuit. And also, we're starting to see people use the designation of authorized representative. So there's an anti-assignment clause. Most payers will allow the designation of an authorized representative, and that will at least get you through the appeals process. And what we like to see for these designations of authorized representative is that they do conform to what the payer form for that is. So it doesn't have to mirror it exactly, but it should as a minimum have on there what the payer's form for such a designation has. And you can look up that information for Avera McKinnon versus Meadowvale Dairy. We'll explain that. And here we have, onto our offset. So what happens when you don't pay the recoupment request, it's not successfully challenged, the payer, if allowed, will go in and start offsetting some claims, which we don't like. And so the right to offset will also be addressed perhaps in the provider contract and in state statute, although a lot of times it is silent. And if a payer does not use an offset to address the overpayments, they may themselves file a lawsuit under the equitable provision in ERISA. So this can be very complicated. So what we've seen through the evolution of case law on lawsuits for equitable relief is tracing is required. Unless that health plan has particular language that would grant the payer an equitable lien by agreement in the overpayment provision of the health plan. If not, they're going to have to try to trace those funds. So this can be very complicated. I'll point you to Saraboff. That's one of the cases that talks about this. Central States versus Health Risk Incorporated. And then Montanville. It's also, I'm sorry that we're running out of time, so I've got to speed through this. But tracing requirement will definitely add a wrinkle into any the payer's attempts to get to that money. And then here we're talking about cross-plan offsetting. So more and more healthcare plans are self-insured. And so when a payer engages in cross-plan offsetting, it can get particularly nasty when you're dealing with self-insured plans versus plans that are fully insured. So so we are definitely challenging recoupments when we suspect that they are engaging in cross-plan offsetting. And you can look at the Peterson case that says that unless that is particularly allowed in the health plan, you cannot engage in cross-plan offsetting, which is more and more and more what we see with the recoupments. And so lastly, we have this newest case that was just filed in the exact same court as the Peterson case, saying that, okay, well, we want you to rule that the whole practice of cross-plan offsetting in every healthcare benefit plan, whether or not it specifically prevents it or not, should be declared a breach of fiduciary duty. So that is the Scott versus United Healthcare case that we are starting to follow here in this practice. So I'm sorry I went over a little bit. Ashley, I'll hand it back to you.
This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on Pulse Nelly website within 24 hours. Thank you all for your participation.